Welcome, dear listener, to this brand new podcast here on Channel Silence, in which I, Gary Lactus, will take you by the gland and guide you meticulously through the greatest comic ever created. A comic which pushes envelopes through the shattered letterbox of sense to deposit the most beautiful slices of solid gold amazing onto the welcome mat of your mind or something. That comic is... Hang on, what's it called? The Mighty Crusaders, number 4, published by the Mighty Comics Group in 1966. Mighty Comics was an imprint of Archie Comics, formerly MLJ. Attempting to ride a train powered by the popularity of Marvel, DC's Silver Age output, and the Batman TV show, Archie Comics put all their superhero eggs into the Mighty Basket. Let's take a look at the cover. This cover wears its Marvel influence on its sleeve by employing the Corner Box. The Corner Box was created by Steve Ditko for Spider-Man issue 2 in 1963. Stan Lee liked the idea and rolled the Corner Box out over all the Marvel titles, all drawn initially by Ditko, so a nice bit of extra work for Ditko there, for which I'm sure he was remunerated fairly. A day's work for a day's pay, which of course he would have loved. The Corner Box of the Mighty Crusaders number 4 features 5 costumed heroes. Up front we have The Shield, a patriotic hero clad in stars and stripes who first appeared in Pep Comics number 1, cover dated January 1940, a few months before the ultimately more popular Captain America. Of this common genre of superhero, which includes Captain Freedom, Fighting Yank, Miss Victory, Yankee Girl, American Belle, Super Soldier, Captain Flag, Lancelot Strong, Yank and Doodle, The American, Agent Liberty, American Eagle, The Americommando, Commander Steel, Fighting American, General Glory, Lady Liberty, Liberty Bell, Major Victory 1, Major Victory 2, Mr. America, Red, White and Blue, Silent Majority, Uncle Sam, Yankee Poodle, Homelander, The Eagle, U.S. Jones, American Eagle 3, Champion of Liberty, Lady Victory, Sergeant Flag, Liberty Girl, American Shield, Original Shield, The Badge, Mr. U.S., Sergeant States, America's Fighting Foot Soldier, The Defender of Liberty, The Proud American, American Ace, American Dream, American Crusader, American Eagle, The Fighting Spirit, The Liberator, Shield Master, Edit Citation Needed, American Made, The First American, U.S. Angel, The All-American, The Frontiersman, The Old Soldier, Lorne Brown Nazi Fighter, Mr. Justice, Guile from Street Fighter, Shield Face, Flag Face, Flag Boy, Freedom Francis, Flag Fucker, U.S. A-hole, and Mr. Sergeant Freedom Flag Fighty Funtimes Man Captain, amongst others. The Shield was the first of these, the original and the best, which says a lot about this incredible comic. The Shield appearing in The Mighty Crusaders is actually the third incarnation of The Shield, Bill Higgins, also known as Joe Higgins Jr. in other appearances. This is because either no one was keeping track because no one gave a shit, unlikely, or because the dedicated and well-paid creators were committed to providing exciting intrigue on every conceivable level of excellence. To the right of the Shield are Flyman and Flygirl. The Fly was created in 1959 by Joe Simon and Jack Kirby. Tommy Troy was an orphan who was set to work by Mean Ben and Abigail March. Tommy Troy was a young boy, by the way. My parents are both orphans. This is great, as I get to tell people that I'm going to visit the orphans at Christmas, and people think I'm kind and brilliant, when actually I'm just making an octogenarian cook me a big dinner. Anyway, it turned out that the Marches were wizards. Tommy found a magic ring and, facilitated by a flyman called Turan of the Fly People from another dimension, ended up with the ability to swap bodies with one of the Fly People, turning him into a superhero. He does this by rubbing his ring and saying, "I wish I were the Fly." The Simon and Kirby studio only did 4 issues before Archie Comics moved production in-house. This changeover included a jump in time, which saw Thomas Troy graduating from law school and remembering that ring of his that turned him into a superhero that he hadn't thought about in years. We've all been there. When I was 11, I got a magic lamp with a genie in it that could grant me 3 wishes. I thought I should take my time to think about what I should wish for. I took so long that I forgot about it sometime in my early 20s. It's still around somewhere, unless it got lost in a move or something. So you see, relatability is a key factor in how great The Fly was as a character. After some adventures, the writers thought they'd really get with the times and get a girl one. Kim Brand was an actress that The Fly rescued, and she ended up getting the same powers somehow. I don't know how. She doesn't have a Wikipedia entry. OK, I've just looked it up, and she got her own ring off Turan, the same fly person from the fly people dimension that gave little Tommy Troy his ring. Well, that was worth it. Happy now? The original run got cancelled in 1964, then relaunched as Flyman in 1965 as part of the Mighty Comics initiative. I guess in the wake of Spider-Man, the name The Fly might have seemed a bit diminutive, so Flyman seemed like the best bet. It might have been fun if they'd gone the other way and changed his name from The Fly to A Fly. Flygirl remained Flygirl, and here they are, in the corner box of the greatest comic ever made. To the left of the shield is Black Hood. Like the original Blue Beetle and The Guardian, Black Hood is a police officer who dresses in an identity-obscuring costume to fight crime without the burden of red tape. It's a lot of effort just to avoid admin. One could easily question whether it's worth it. It's an interesting inversion of reality, where it's more common for violent bastards to become cops in order to get away with heinous crimes. He first appeared in Top Notch Comics, number 9, October 1940, and went on to become one of MLJ's most popular characters, even getting his own radio serial for a while. The original Black Hood, Matthew Berland, was trained by a hermit to fight evil. I love that. A hermit. I guess the very nature of hermits, living alone, having no contact with the outside world, means that people who live in society, people with friends and family and communication technology, can only imagine what hermits get up to. A friend of mine had a kind of hermit guy living near him, where he was, when he was growing up in Norfolk, he lived in a shed and foraged for food. Not exactly a hermit, because the local community would check he was okay. He ate squirrels. My friend once asked him what it tasted like. "It tastes like otter," was the reply. My friend did not learn how to fight evil from that guy. The Black Hood's popularity waned, and by the late 40s, he had been consumed by funny animal comics. Thank God he came back to give the Mighty Crusaders the off-duty policeman dressed in skin-tight black and yellow who punches people it so desperately needed. Finally, on the far left, we have The Comet. Created by Jack Cole, The Comet made his first appearance in 1940 within the pages of Pep Comics. John Dickering is a scientist who discovers a new gas, so he injects it into his bloodstream, which means he can fly and shoot disintegration beams from his eyes and fight crime, which he did for 17 issues. Then he was the first superhero to ever get killed. His brother seeks revenge by becoming a vengeful bastard of a superhero called the Hangman. For the Mighty Crusaders, the Comet was brought back to life or simply reintroduced as a new comet. Not sure. I can't be asked to research any further, and I'm not going to actually go and read any of these comics. This podcast is about the Mighty Crusaders, number 4, the greatest comic in the whole world. Why would I need to go and read anything else ever again? The Comet's Mighty Comics costume is shit, by the way. He's got this thing on his head, which looks like a rainbow turban, but it's a helmet with a little peak at the front. Oh yes, and he has a weaselly little moustache. And that's the corner box done. Let's move on to the cover as a whole. On the top right, there's the reassuring sight of that familiar stamp, letting us know that the Mighty Crusaders number 4 is approved by the Comics Code Authority. Thank Jesus! This comic will not pervert my mind. Below the crimson letters, letting us know that this is a comic called The Mighty Crusaders, is the immortal title of the story within. Too Many Superheroes. The cover depicts a brawl between 13 characters. Flygirl isn't present, probably because girls can barely throw and catch, let alone do punching. but the rest of the guys are there. Shield is punching a green-clad guy in a black mask. Black Hood is getting punched by a guy dressed in blue, black and white. Flyman is squaring up to nothing in particular, whilst a purple villain falls over near him. We can tell he's a villain because he's ugly, bald and a bit rotund. The Comet looks like he's getting punched in the stomach or balls, hard to tell by the way he's bending. It is unclear what exactly is going on in this composition. Apart from the two definite connecting punches, everyone else is just sort of punching and running and falling over. There are some speed lines which look like they're intended to convey the arc of flying fists, but they don't properly correspond to any particular fists. The Shield has a couple of these lines. One makes more sense than the other, and the Comet looks like the line itself is knocking out his stuffing. In short, the cover is a confusing splurge of super nonsense, asking more questions than it gives answers. What is happening? Why is what is happening? Who's he? And him? Is he? No, he isn't. Is 13 too many superheroes? For some, yes. For others, no. For those who believe they can handle more superheroes before their too many superheroes threshold is shattered, they may yet be overwhelmed by what lies within these pages. Let's open that cover, shall we? Boys, girls, ladies, men, just answer this advertisement. We'll send you, without cost, whichever ring you want. Handsome signet ring. The ring you receive will be personalized with your own initial, made of sturdy nickel silver, polished and rhodium plated for bright long wear. Sizes quickly adjustable to fit any finger. Fascinating zodiac ring. Made of sturdy brass in a 16-karat gold electroplated finish, this ring will show the star sign of your own birth month, size quickly adjustable to fit any finger. This is our way of introducing the fabulous Get Things plan, just for becoming our star salesman. Amazing premiums, just for selling popular Cloverine salve. Sent to you on trust. No charge. It's fun. It's easy. We'll send you 12 boxes of Cloverine salve for chaps, chafes and mild burns. A dependable product on the market since 1895. You sell it to friends, relatives and neighbours at 65 cents a box. You send no money to get Cloverine salve. We ship it to you on trust. After you have sold your salve, you remit the proceeds to us and make a selection of the premium you want from our big premium catalogue, which will be sent to you along with the salve. The more expensive premiums will require you to sell additional quantities of salve. It's all specified in our catalogue, but to get many premiums you need only to sell one order, or one dozen boxes. In any case, the ring you choose, as described above, will come to you without cost. It's yours to keep. There are pictures here. There's illustrations of the rings. They look, even though they're line drawings, they look quite cheap. There's a boy and a girl happily smiling. Pictures of a bike, baseball bat, baseball mitt, snorkeling set, bow and arrow, dolly, camera, radio, ice skates. Here are other valuable premiums you can get. Official Beatle guitars, Bibles, train travel case, Scout knapsack, fishing outfits, Scout axe and knife set, latest popular records, 45 RPM and 33s, outdoor grills, complete aluminium wear sets, croquet set, build-it-yourself canoe, 1,000-shot Daisy air rifle for selling 4 dozen, your own personalised stationery and notepaper, badminton set, tool chests, jewellery sets, dozens more in our catalogue. Don't wait! Mail coupon. We trust you. Hillcrest Products Co., Inc., Department 104, 13, Tyrone, PA. Your important instructions. Please read. This coupon will bring ring and salve. Please send me without cost. Do you know what? I don't think I need to actually read the coupon. These sort of advertisements for child labour were all over comics and pulp magazines right through the 20th century. I've often wondered how well they worked, so I decided to do some deep research by Googling cloverine salve and clicking on the National Museum of American History website, which was the very first result. It has a bunch of people's memories, which I can just copy and paste into this script and save myself a lot of writing time. My mother sold the salve and got a print of Jesus, Sandra LaRocca. My father loved to write, and one essay he did was about the many jobs he held over the years. He noted that, as a kid, he sold cloverine salve door-to-door in our little New England town. I said, "What the heck is cloverine salve?" I had to look it up. Dad was a fine salesman. He sold new and used cars before I was born, and often a shopper intent on buying a used car drove home with a new one. He was in real estate for many years and loved the task of matching the right house to the right family. He was also a politician. He was in the Air Corps overseas in World War II. My beloved dad passed away at age 97 this past March. I bet it isn't widely known that some heroes start out selling cloverine salve. Lorrie Blair. I have one of the Hoban .22 rifles they gave as prizes. Brent. If my dad was still living, he would be 88 today. As a young boy, he sold cloverine salve door to door, and some of the ads listed one of the prizes as being a live pony. Cindy Glasgow Houlihan. When I was a little girl, I sold cloverine salve. I was trying to sell enough to win the grand prize, a live monkey. I can still see the ad. Was so exciting. Unfortunately, I didn't sell enough for the grand prize, Donna Sturgis. What would anyone want with a monkey? I sold cloverine salve when I was 9 years old. I was trying to win the grand prize, a monkey. I gave up once I realised that I would have to sell enough salve to fill the inside of our house. That was my first attempt at selling. It stayed with me all my life, and I later won many awards selling other products. I also started a business that sold products throughout the US and some foreign countries. Ooh, foreign countries. That's not very American. Ray Steelman. When I sold cloverine salve, they sent enough prints that one could be given with each purchase. Some didn't want one, so in time I had enough that the last sale from that shipment still had a choice of which one they wanted. Larry Ferguson. Great story, Larry. Cloverine salve was in a tin years ago. I am now 78 years old, but I remember selling the salve as a young boy and got a meat grinder for my mum. Dale. I'm actually recording this on Valentine's Day, and do you know what? A meat grinder would have made the perfect gift for Lady Lactus, and I just feel regret now. When I was 5 or 6 years old, I walked alone door to door in my rural farm community in southeastern Ohio, selling tins of cloverine salve. Every purchaser got a free print of their choice. The prints were rolled up inside the cardboard tube that contained the tins of salve. I earned enough money to purchase a little typewriter and was very proud of myself. Beverly Steinfield. And that one actually has a reply. Precisely where in southeastern Ohio? I sold in that area also. Fred Connors. I get the feeling that Fred Connors didn't do well enough to purchase a little typewriter and has never forgotten it. All of his life he sought to find someone to blame, and he may just have found that person in Beverly Steinfeld. I hope Beverly is safe, and that the authorities have their eye on Fred. Sadly, this child labour scheme, in which children were turned into salespeople on the very American promises of ponies, monkeys, guns and Jesus, was made illegal a year after this comic in 1967. And more insidious ways of controlling children had to be invented. Very sad. Much as I would like to end this first episode at this point, I feel we should actually cover some of the story contained within The Mighty Crusaders No. 4. Although calling it a story seems to denigrate what is the world's most incredible chunk of dynamic amazing ever to be rendered in two dimensions. 1966 was a peak time for the popularity of folk rock music. with artists like Bob Dylan and The Byrds enjoying huge success and fueling the emergent hippie movement. As we have already noted, Mighty Comics were trying to emulate the success of Marvel. Comics seemed exciting and vibrant, and were being read by teenagers, even older people. Mighty Comics needed to get hip to the scene, and talk to the young men who were growing their hair and getting poetic. On page one of The Mighty Crusaders number 4, the first panel takes up the length and width of the page in an inverted L shape. This panel is filled with a singing man, with hair down to his ears, playing a semi-acoustic 10-string guitar. A 10-string guitar is unusual, or the artist didn't bother looking at a guitar properly. He is singing. I will attempt a kind of Bob Dylan style for this.
Hiya, loyal royal readers, here's your mighty minstrel friend, with my big fat mouth wide open, wobbling folk music again. I've a tale to tell you, this time what's a mighty comics great, about a zillion superheroes who we're bringing up to date. Way back in the early 40s, MLJ Mag, Ultra Heroes reigned supreme. Y'all see 'em in this here mag, in answer to fans' screams. Mr. Justice, Captain Flag, Blackjack, to mention just a few. So have a ball, enjoy yourselves, Ki-Yippee and Yahoo, yes sir!
Ki-Yippee and Yahoo, yes sir! I don't know if the Mighty Minstrel is a regular in this comic. Either way, the tone it aims for feels absurdly irrelevant to the rest of the comic, which is why it's brilliant. There's the added enjoyment coming from the fact that I can't help feeling like whoever wrote the Mighty Minstrel's words here hated the idea, and the type of musician they were trying to emulate, with his big fat mouth wide open, warbling folk music again. The folk music of the 60s was synonymous with protest, and I get the impression the writer did not approve, and would rather young upstarts like this guy would cut their hair and work hard, maybe getting children to sell guns door-to-door for Jesus with the prospect of owning a lion as payment. At the bottom of this panel is a caption, reading, "Only the incredibly inspired Mighty Comics group Jolly Wackos could have had the genius, the power and the glory, and the downright nerve to concoct an epic masterpiece of such dazzling, unforgettable splendour." This may well be true. I certainly have never come across a comic quite like this before, and it surely must be the work of a group of particularly jolly wackos. The second panel on this page, sitting within the incongruous frame of The Mighty Minstrel, restates the title of the comic with The Mighty Crusaders in Too Many Superheroes at the top. Below this, standing around on either a patch of grass or a vast field, there's no way to tell, are the five team members, Flyman, The Shield, Flygirl, The Comet, and The Black Hood. To the left of the panel is some kind of metallic technology. It is unclear whether this is a vehicle, some kind of crime-fighting computer console, or futuristic hostess trolley. The Mighty Crusaders number 4 is full of these sort of ambiguities, leaving more than the usual amount to the imagination. When something asks so much of the reader, every reader will experience a different comic, each reading revealing something about the individual reader. Profound. On the ground beneath the Crusaders is a black star. The characters are stood at each of the star's 5 points. This star wasn't immediately apparent to me. Without the close examination I'm giving The Mighty Crusaders number 4 for this podcast, my brain perceived the blackness beneath them as shadow. The way this black star has revealed itself feels a bit magic. So I've had a little dig into the relevance of the symbol. In 1919, as part of the Back to Africa movement, Marcus Garvey founded the Black Star Line, which modelled its name on that of the British shipping company White Star Line, changing the colour from white to black to symbolise ownership by black people rather than white people. The black star became a symbol of Pan-Africanism and anti-colonialism. Given that this comic shamefully has exclusively white people in it, I don't see any significance here. According to a discussion on anarchy101.org, in Western magical tradition, stars are the dead, the ancestors. The star is black. As with the other black anarchist symbols, flag, mask, etc. Because black is the colour of death, and also of negation, the unseen and the invisible. So taking these together, we see that the black star symbolises the dead who are forgotten and erased by history. This idea has some resonance given the story which, I would say unfolds, but it just sort of dollops or spills or splatters. Actually, maybe it smears. The five heroes are all looking at a bubble, 5 or 6 foot in diameter, which is floating a little above the grass like a giant crystal ball. Inside the ball are the faces of the heroes. Flyman says, "Hey, Comet, what's wrong with the starolator? When we congregate, the globe that's formed is supposed to pictorially alert us to great emergencies." Fantastically natural dialogue. Flygirl adds, "But it's only picturing the five of us looking terribly aggravated. Why?" The faces don't look terribly aggravated, by the way. They look rather blank. A bit miffed, maybe. Like they've all got resting bitch face. The expressions certainly don't warrant the reaction they're getting. Comet is as surprised as anyone here as he exclaims, "Even though I invented it, I don't know!" The comet is facing away from the reader here, and we can see on the top of his stupid rainbow helmet turban thing a small black star. And we learn that the globe is called the starolator. Okay, this explains the black star. It's the comet's thing. He's the guy with the gear. If the Mighty Crusaders were a band, Comet would be in it because he could drive and had a van. Below this pulse-steadying tableau reads the credits. Award-winning editing by Rick G, spelt G-E-E. Ultra-type writing by Jerry S, spelt E-S-S. Breathtaking art by Paul R, spelt A-R-E. Another colouring masterpiece by Victor, T-O-R-R. That's the second use of the word masterpiece there on this page. Quite right, too. The way the credits are presented here is clearly an attempt to emulate Marvel's chummy nicknames like Smilin' Stan Lee, Jolly Jack Kirby, Steve Diphtheria Ditko, or whatever. Here we see the creators' names reduced to phonetically spelt initials, showing either a paucity of imagination or a wealth of simple classic style. I know which one I think it is, and that one is the one that it definitely is. So let's look at who these jolly wackos are. Editor Rick G is actually Richard Goldwater. At only 30 years old, Richard was the guy hip enough to helm this crew and inject the Mighty Crusaders with the youthful spunk that drips from every page. Richard joined Archie Comics straight out of college. He worked his way up from the mailroom to editor in just a few years. His talent cannot be underestimated. This talent was particularly remarkable in that his father, John Goldwater, is one of the founders and co-publishers of Archie, formerly MLJ Comics. What are the chances? John Goldwater went on to become editor-in-chief of Archie Comics. Victor is actually Victor Gorlick, who graduated from college having majored in cartooning. I didn't know that comic production was covered by higher education back then. It's quite interesting. Working his way up through the company's arts department, he learned how to colour comics, and he coloured this comic. A seemingly lowly task, but this Victor became the victor by becoming editor-in-chief of Archie Comics, the jolliest of wackos. I can't find anything particularly interesting in Victor Gorlick's story. Good name, though. Gorlick. He seems like a nice guy. I like his cozy story of working his way up and staying with the same company all his life. It fits with the wholesome image that Archie likes to project. Paul R. is Paul Reinman, 65 when he drew this. Reinman was possibly losing his enthusiasm for comics. his best work having already happened in war comics in the 50s. He'd worked in commercial art, been a neon artist, drawn the Golden Age Human Torch, Namor, Green Lantern, the Atom, and a bunch of other superheroes, drawn Bible comics, horror, crime, and inked Jack Kirby on early issues of The Hulk and X-Men. He drifted away from comics in the 70s and wound up his career as a courtroom sketch artist. Oh, it says here he drew John Force. Is that John Force or John Force? I hope it's John Force. I'd like there to be a super team brought together because they all had the same name. They could combine into one giant John with the power of 10 Johns, firing a powerful John ray from his Johnson. Let's see. Oh, it's John Force, magic agent. A government agent with an eye patch and a magic coin, whatever. But who is this Jerry S? This jolly wacko who did this ultra-type writing? It's none other than Jerry Siegel. Alongside his childhood friend, Joe Shuster, Jerry Siegel created Superman, the world's first costumed superpowered hero. You've probably heard of him. Superman is one of the most potent symbols created in the last 100 years. A symbol so powerful he scared Nazis into writing their own counter-propaganda. In a 1940 SS newspaper, an article dripping with anti-Semitism attacks Siegel and describes Superman as a pleasant guy with an overdeveloped body and underdeveloped mind, and mocks his bathing suit. It actually reads a bit like a Jeremy Clarkson column. Superman was one of the first superheroes my son, and no doubt countless other children, was aware of. Although the pull of Spider-Man has his interest currently. Superman. You know what Superman is. Everyone knows what Superman is. Siegel's financial struggles are well known, earning a pittance compared to the wealth generated by he and Schuster's creation. He also created a large number of other characters still in use today, such as Dr. Occult, The Spectre, Robot Man, and a big chunk of the Legion of Superheroes like Chameleon Boy, Lightning Lord, Brainiac 5, and Phantom Girl. Siegel has created characters that have echoed through the ages. By far his greatest work is The Mighty Crusaders No. 4. A work which shall no doubt echo louder and longer than the rest of his work combined. It just so happens that we're still waiting for that first echo. Maybe this incredible podcast is that first echo. Yes, it definitely is. And here you are listening to it. You are here at the start of a new ultra age of amazing, where every person on this troubled planet will be elevated to become jolly wackos. Well, we've covered the cover, the advert on the inside cover, and the first page. I think that's enough for now. Hope you liked it. If you did, let me know, as it's quite a bit of work, and right now I have no idea if I've just recorded an annoying load of shit that no one wants. I'm aiming to get one of these done a month and put it on the Silence Patreon, patreon.com/silence. I will need support to get through this project. So if you refer enough friends to the Silence Patreon, you could win a monkey. Next time, we'll be looking at the second page, maybe even more. I hope you'll join me, Gary Lactus, here, next time, here. On the Mighty Crusaders No. 4.